Hi everyone, this is Mia with Emergent Strategy, and you are tuned in to our podcast. Thank you so much. I want to give you a little bit of a heads up in advance that it was my first time recording a podcast and the technology did not serve me. So I want to apologize because my volume is really low throughout the conversation and kind of weirdly high in other moments. And so I just want to say, please extend a bit of grace and know that where I may falter, Shane is crystal clear. With that, I hope you enjoy.
Being taught that humans are the supreme being, I've been healing from, as a grower, I've been healing from learning not to impose my will upon the land and to ask for permission, to ask for consent.
Hello, and welcome to the Emergent Strategy podcast, hosted by the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. We are a collective of facilitators, mediators, trainers, and curious human beings interested in how we get in right relationship with change. Emergent strategy is the way we generate and reshape complex systems and patterns with relatively simple interactions. My name is Mia. The Mason, facilitator, acupuncturist, and a Black mama with ESII. And today I'm so fortunate to be able to talk to Shane Bernardo about emergent strategy in his life. Shane is a co-founder of Food as Healing, a social movement based on ancestral earth-based traditions that are critical for maintaining our identities, sense of belonging, health, and wholeness. Shane is also a grower, anti-oppression facilitator, storyteller, and food justice organizer based in Detroit, Michigan, that uses food and the stories embedded within them as mediums for healing and decolonizing. So thank you so much today for joining.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so honored.
And today we're doing this on the day that 45 officially lost his job. So we got a little, you know, celebration in the air, a little celebration in the air.
Oh, yes. This moment feels so surreal, I should say.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's taken a bit for all of us to fully breathe in what many of us understand as a movement victory, that, you know, we were making space for our communities to be heard, to ensure that our votes are counted, and to really take a stand for the life that we want and that we need, that we knew 45 stood in the way of.
Absolutely. A collective effort. People were organizing really hard and pulling for their communities. Detroit, Philly, Georgia, Stacey Abrams, the ancestors, everybody.
Yes. And I know that your relationship and your work with ancestors is a big part of what keeps you clear and focused and moving. So yeah, I don't know if you want to just say a little bit more about your experience and understanding of emergent strategy and how your relationship with the ancestors guides that.
Yeah, totally. Thank you again for this opportunity to share space with you and be a part of the inaugural season of the Emergent Strategy podcast. I love you and I love the work that you do and the work that Adrian and all the other ES facilitators are doing to make this a better place and world to live in. I'm very encouraged by the work that Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute is doing, because it provides a platform and a framework where we can see all of our work interconnected. So it's allowing me as a person and a facilitator to move from a place of scarcity to abundance. And that essentially is the work of Emergent Strategies, is to move out of an extractive system to a more resilient one, one that's built on interdependence and abundance, moving away from linear systems to circular ones. And that goes right in line with the healing work that I do, and in particular around bringing in the sense of sacredness and reverence in my life and my work as an organizer, facilitator, grower, and a healer.
Thank you so much for that. That's beautiful. Yeah, I really appreciate the way in which all of these different streams of work are coming together for you. And I agree that like this very notion of creating more possibilities has indeed ensured that we all can show up with our gifts in this moment in the best way possible. And so, and that being said, we've all had to make a lot of adaptations in this moment because we are in the midst of COVID-19 still, and the ways in which it is impacting our communities. And a little bit earlier, we were checking in and I wanted to hear how you've made adaptations in this moment to show up as a healer and as a facilitator, understanding the context that we're in.
Yeah. Thank you for that framing. It's really critical to look at the current moment through that lens, because COVID, although the world has seen pandemics before, this particular moment is different because of where we are politically and historically. And what I mean by that is that, like, to put it another way, I've heard Adrienne Marie Brown say that things aren't getting worse, they're just being unearthed or revealed. And so as it relates to COVID, that if we look at how things have played out, it's played out in ways that have reinforced racial disparities, and in particular for Black communities and Indigenous communities, communities that have been most hardly impacted by the climate crisis and settler colonialism and anti-Black racism. And so it's really important to not over-intellectualize this moment, but to put it in the proper context. So we're not just like passively responding to this moment, but we know what the root causes of why we have these racial disparities. Because it's not just that we're in a pandemic. We also have to look at how it's been mishandled, because it's been revealed which communities have been hit hardest. Mm-hmm. That's why it's been mishandled. And so we have to deal with these realities in a very honest and truthful way, so that we can start shuffling resources to those that are most impacted by these disparities.
I see. I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, that's the basis of equity. And I'm wondering, like, and what that has meant for you in a primarily Black city, and in a relationship with land where you are really working to honor Indigenous practice in relationship to land, kind of what that's meant for your own practice in this moment.
You know, this has been such a personal journey. This is not like a profession for me. Mm-hmm. It's not something I do for an income. This is something I do to survive and thrive. So to put this in political and historical context, like I was saying earlier, is that my ancestors are from the Philippines, and I'm first generation of my family to be born over here. And so in recognition of all of that, I must also come to grips with how the Philippines was a colonial possession of the United States, and that how Western imperialism and settler colonialism has played a role in both the lives of indigenous people of Turtle Island and also people within the Philippine diaspora. And so it's a very personal journey of mine to align myself with the struggles of people that were brought here to be enslaved, and also people that have suffered genocide, and also my ancestors that have suffered from Spanish colonial rule, but also U.S. imperialism. And so the work that I do around land is in very sober recognition of these histories. And so I'm carrying on the work of our collective ancestors to align myself with the land struggles, both at home and abroad. It's a very serious and very explicit way that I approach my work and my personal journey.
I wonder what it means to then be in a place where you are aligning and listening. I'm wondering like kind of what it means to be in a relationship of listening to the land in a way that we can also understand emergent strategy through. What does that mean to you when you're in this deep relationship with land? How does it teach you? What are the ways and the rhythms that you observe in order to support this calling of yours?
So what Emergent Strategies has really lent me in terms of doing this healing work with the land and around food, but also myself as a caregiver, is that it has provided language, concepts, and practices around listening to the land, listening to the cosmos, listening to nature. And what that does for me is that it decentralizes me as a human being, as not being the center. So being decentered, but also being invited into this idea that I'm part of a larger whole is a really beautiful notion, but also how we get from an extractive system to a more regenerative one, and also to a place of looking at our struggles as being co-aligned with one another. And so in the same way that me and my people are fighting for indigenous sovereignty back home, and it's also aligned with people fighting for self-determination and indigenous sovereignty here. So in terms of like listening, it's like being in the majority Black city is that I have to learn how to decenter myself and lead with the spirit of humility, lead with a spirit of tenderness, kindness, and compassion, which is which is a lifelong struggle. So I'm healing from being taught that humans are the supreme being. I've been healing from, as a grower, I've been healing from learning not to impose my will upon the land and to ask for permission, to ask for consent. And in terms of listening, pausing and paying attention to what is already growing here. Like everything has a role and a purpose. And that role and that purpose is not how much, it's not based on how much wealth we can extract from the land. Wage love. Wage love. Wage love. Wage love. Wage love. This is for Shetty R. Dedicate this with a heavy heart. Thank you for sharing that. You know, I find so much inside of what you're saying about what it means to unlearn patterns of, in order to deeply listen, in order to be kind of in right relationship with land and people. And then I'm also wondering how, like, what are the similarities or differences in terms of listening to the land and then listening to people? Are there different qualities or ways of being that are necessary, or actually is it that, you know, there's a way in which you're being and listening to the land that helps inform and shape how you then relate to folks either in your life or folks who are working on struggles for land? Yeah, there's a couple things there that we need to realize is that as human beings, we operate within multiple systems, and we operate, whether we recognize it or not, we operate within a spiritual realm. We operate within a natural realm, and we operate within a fabricated realm where capitalism is king, so to speak. And so part of the listening that needs to happen is to be able to listen to the conditioning and how we got here and how that shapes our experiences, and to reclaim the kind of listening that we need to do in order to be in right relationship with the land, the natural world, and the spirit world. And that takes a different type of consciousness. So sometimes it takes listening with a different kind of ear, if you will, to not blind ourselves to the violence that is happening in the fabricated world, but to see how there are possibilities that exist beyond this realm. Like I've been thinking about this in terms of like relationships and how consumerism, for example, has infiltrated the way that we see one another. And it's conditioned us to look at one another as commodities, as valuing our personhood in the way that benefits us materially. And that's such a narrow and a dehumanizing way of seeing one another. But that's a product of our fabricated realm. So what value do we have in the natural realm? What value do we have in the spirit realm? And that's what I'm attempting to relearn. And that's what I'm attempting to ground my new sense of listening in. And that kind of work is fundamental to emergent strategies. That kind of work is fundamental to doing healing work.
Yeah, I mean, I so appreciate this because we have to believe in our inherent value and worthiness outside of what the world says in order to be fully present and create the world that we want to be in, right? I was recently listening to a conversation between Gibran Rivera and Femi. Remember her last name right now, but she talked about the way in which African folk who are enslaved in this country had to move beyond the material in terms of an understanding of our value, because the material, we were told we didn't have any value in it, right? And everything that was material could be so easily taken away. And so there had to be this like deep connection to soul, to like feeling at another level, listening at another level, being present there. And that just really resonates, that sense of like, oh, right, we find our meaning not in what we produce, but we find our meaning in our just being and what that means in relationship to the other beings that we get to be with. In terms of what you're saying, this sense of being able to listen and attune another way, I am wondering kind of what that means for you. I've recently seen you talking about the relationship that you have with your father on Instagram and what it means to be cultivating that ancestral practice and relationship and that way of listening. And I'm wondering if you feel comfortable just sharing a little bit about what it means to listen at that level again to ancestors and to listen for what is theirs and what is ours, to listen for their guidance, but also, and also to listen for the places where they're still healing as well.
As a facilitator, I've learned, and this is something that I've learned from observing Adrian, is that conflict is an opportunity to deepen our relationships with one another. Whereas like fear and anxiety and discomfort may compel us to run, flee, freeze. What was the other one? Flee, freeze, and you know what I'm talking about?
Appease. Yeah, fight, flight, freeze, appease. And sometimes disassociate.
That's right. Or appease. Mm-hmm. Right. And so as it pertains to my relationship with my father, who is now an ancestor, I inherited his struggles. And as a facilitator for emergent strategies, I had to learn to put myself in his position. I had to learn to empathize with him. And it wasn't until he became an ancestor that I was able to do that, because I had such a strained relationship with him growing up. Like, he was a disciplinarian in the house. So my relationship with him wasn't always the best. I do have some really fond memories, and some of those include working with him in the garden for long hours after he put in a full day of work. This was a place of solace for him to come back home and disengage with the world and decompress. And I saw that how I didn't learn this until much later in my life, but I saw how he was transmuting grief in the garden, and how that grief was being put into the ground. And so as a facilitator, I'm learning how to compost conflict. I'm learning how to compost grief. And I learned that from my ancestors. I learned that from my father. And I see the role that our connection to earth and earth-based practices is so essential to that process of healing. In terms of organizing, facilitating and healing, that we need to do both. Like that inner work is so critical, because I've seen firsthand how movement spaces recreate the violence that we're trying to push up against. And we bring these inner struggles into our movement spaces. I've seen toxic masculinity. I've seen discrimination against disabled folks. I've seen heteronormativity rear its head. I've seen all these things in movement spaces. And so we need to really get a grasp on things like fear, anxiety, discomfort, trauma, intergenerational trauma, grief in particular. Grief is actually really useful, a really useful emotion in that way, because my father, in my work with my father as an ancestor, that he's shown me how that if you follow grief down far enough, it will also show you how deeply you have cared, how deeply you have loved, because you can only grieve as deeply as you have loved. And it's because of my love for him is that I was able to go down to that deep place and find healing. Doing healing work with my father, I was also able to heal myself as someone who had inherited his trauma of being a displaced person in the diaspora. I had to take on his struggles as my own so that I could transmute it, and so that I didn't pass it on, and so that I didn't bring it into my movement spaces where I'm harming other people around lateral violence. And so that took an incredible amount of kindness and compassion and tenderness for him, but also for myself. I had to give myself compassion when I didn't have the energy to do that because I felt so beat up by the world. So it's really important for us to not re-victimize ourselves and to play the role of the oppressor, but to really get big in our hearts and to really lean on this idea of interdependence and abundance. And, oh my goodness, forgiveness is such a gift. I've had to forgive him, and I've also had to forgive myself for doing the work of the oppressor. So I don't take this work lightly. Like I said, this is a personal journey of mine, and I bring a lot of myself and this healing journey into my healing work and also my facilitation work. They're so intertwined, it's really hard to find where it begins and ends.
I mean, oh, thank you for that. What a word. And also reminds me that, you know, you've talked about in this moment being in a role of caretaking deeply for primarily in this time. And so I don't know if you want to just talk about what it's meant for you to see yourself as not only kind of transmuting and shifting what's happened in the past, but then carrying forward this kind of legacy of care. Yeah, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, or we can.
Yeah, I would actually love to talk about that. And in doing so, in being able to talk about it in this way, gives us another perspective on how this all operates. So, namely, I'm caregiving for my brother, who has also had a really strained relationship with my father for similar reasons. And he's younger than me. He's 3 years younger than me. And he was actually my father's caregiver for 10 years. He stayed at home with him while after he had his stroke and up until the time that he transitioned. And so now it's my turn to caregive for my brother, who played such a prominent role in my life and my father's life. And it's because of my brother that I was then able to go out and do the work that a lot of people know me for. So I have a huge debt to him for doing that work, for doing that care work. And so now myself as a caregiver for him, I can see firsthand, and I can see so clearly because of how my father's struggles impacted me. I can see so clearly how their interpersonal struggles and how intergenerational trauma has played out in his life. And my brother, like when my brother's healing from cancer, and one of the places he needs healing around is his liver. And in Eastern medicine and in TCM and traditional Chinese medicine, they associate certain organs with processing certain emotion. And anger and rage is processed in the liver. And so seeing that this is an area that needs healing for him tells me that he suppressed a lot of rage. He suppressed a lot of anger. And to the point where it's weakened that organ where the cancer has metastasized. And it comes from not being able to express himself emotionally because of how we've been conditioned to be in our family around our feelings, that we had to be strong. We couldn't express weakness, that we had to endure things and be better than our American counterparts. And in striving for this myth around the American dream, we had to be better and we couldn't show weakness. And that's something that my father definitely embodied. And so as a caregiver, I've been able to see a little bit more objectively the healing journey that my brother is on as his caregiver, and see how these things are manifesting in his body. And so I'm seeing the interplay and the duality between things like love and grief. I'm seeing the interplay and duality between rage and its antithesis. And it's also allowed me to develop a heightened sense of listening as well as it pertains to what is emerging and how do we adapt to these moments. And so in the same way that sometimes in our struggles, when we've learned to suppress our emotions, that we sometimes can embody our shadows. Sometimes we can embody our trauma. Sometimes we can embody our struggles. And so in that way, myself and my brother and my other siblings, we've learned to do those same things. We've learned to embody rage. We've learned to embody fear. We've learned to embody grief. But the beautiful thing about that, and again, this comes from my skill and experience around being a facilitator, is that there's a duality to everything, including our shadows. And so in looking at grief, there's also the presence of love. In looking at fear and rage, in anger, there's also the presence of joy. And so how do we get to a place that we're not only embodying fear, anxiety, discomfort, trauma, grief, anger, and rage, but how are we also learning to embody love and joy and forgiveness? And we can do both. We don't have to suppress our rage. So part of the work is acknowledging the presence of both.
What does it take emotionally, ritually, to be in a practice of vulnerability that care for your beloved requires? You know, how do these practices look in your daily life?
Thank you for that question. Caregiving has really become a way in which, a primary way in which I practice healing and facilitation work in my daily life. And the best way that I can explain it is that caregiving is like being an open hand rather than a balled up fist. That you can't caregive with an iron hand. I'm not even sure you can caregive with an iron glove. but you really have to do it from a place of humility, because it's an honor. You're doing spirit work, you're doing energy work, you're doing body work. Like I've noticed how some of my healing compadres and friends that do body and energy work, like Reiki and massage and yoga and Tai Chi and acupuncture, like you, you're all doing energy and body work and spirit work. And there is a ritual of processing, transmuting, and grounding some of the secondary trauma that we can pick up in our roles as caregivers and energy workers and body workers and spirit workers, is that we have to constantly empty our cup, so to speak, or empty our palms, empty our hands of this energy so that we can continue our work as caregivers. And what that looks like for me on a daily basis is that every morning before I meet the day is that I'm doing something for myself in order to do that work, to be that open hand, to empty my cup, so to speak. And I do that, it looks different depending on what time of the year it is, which I also really like, because these practices can evolve and align themselves with the breath and rhythm of the season. So when it's warmer, I can go sit in my garden. I can sit in my garden, I can transmute this grief and earth it into the ground. And I can practice my land-based ancestral traditions and reclaim them. And I can sit with my ancestors outside in my garden. I actually see my garden as an altar. Like an altar doesn't have to be like a mantle of some kind with candles and a vessel of water and pictures and stuff like that. Like it could be anywhere. And for me, my garden is that place of sacredness and reverence. another way that I continue to like recharge myself and my capacity to do care work is by having a gratitude practice. And Any time that I sit down and eat, is I say my gratitudes. I say what I'm grateful for. And I do this every time I eat because praying has become so normalized in our society, so I don't feel ashamed of doing it. So I just take and make space in order to do that work every time I eat. So I do it at least 3 times a day. And I'm thanking the creator, I'm thanking the earth, I'm thanking my ancestors, I'm thanking people that have cultivated, prepared, and served my food. And I'm asking for guidance from my ancestors and the creator. And so incorporating gratitude into our daily practice is also a form of ritual as well. A friend of mine demystified ritual and ceremony for me by saying that anytime you take a breath, that's a cause for celebration. That's a cause for ceremony and ritual. And there's such a level of sincerity and sacredness that's behind that thought. Another way that I practice being an open hand or palm is also giving thanks to my water body. So I talked about being in relationship with the soil and my garden and being in relationship with my earth body and my ancestors. I also practice being in relationship with my water body. And so what that looks like in practice is when I'm in the shower, I'm thanking the water for cleansing me of negative energy and karmic debt. Because water, smoke, and other things, plants can whisk away a lot of those things like negative energy. Like some people wear stones, some people wear amulets, some people wear copper and silver as armor. But if you don't have any of those things, what do? You can use water. And taking a shower is not just like cleaning yourself of like physical dirt, but you can cleanse yourself of like karmic debt and negative energy while you're taking a bath too. And so when I'm in the shower, I thank the creator and I ask the creator to cleanse me of all negative energy and karmic debt and to ground it into the earth. So that's another way that we can transmute the secondary trauma that we're experiencing as caregivers and healers and spirit workers and body workers and energy workers, and continue to do this really important work around care.
Well, I do actually want you to talk a little bit more about your work, your practice around food as healing in your community. I had an opportunity once to see a video of you making a meal and sharing a meal, talking about the food. I was like, shame! Look at Shane! And then I was also feeling that FOMO because I wasn't eating it. Anyway, so I would love if you could just share a little bit more about what that practice means for you and how you see it connected to emergent strategy.
Well, first off, whenever this pandemic is, I don't know, whenever we get through it, I would love to cook with you and share space around the meal. That's one of my that's one of my love languages. But yeah, like really very practically, like food is a really great convener. We all have a very personal and emotional connection to food, no matter who we are. And being a person in the Philippine diaspora on Turtle Island and having this analysis around Western imperialism and settler colonialism and how that's impacted us as a collective, BIPOC folks in particular, is that food has also been very useful in understanding our relationship to land and our land-based practices in our ancestral traditions around spirituality, storytelling, oral tradition, and how a lot of these things were passed down orally. We didn't have a written language. And so like part of this work is also revaloring embodied knowledge. Part of this work is also revaloring ancestral memory that's embodied within us. And so the work around food as healing is learning to connect our bodies, mind, and spirit all together, whereas Western imperialism and colonialism has cut ourselves off at the neck. And we've forgotten to uphold and reclaim and preserve our embodied knowledge, our ancestral memory that comes from being in relationship with the land. And I've found that food is a really great way of doing that because it acts as a proxy, in particular for those of us that are in the diaspora, to reconnect with land. Because a lot of our traditional foods and meals have come from places where only those ingredients will grow. And so by celebrating, making, and sharing some of these meals is part of reclaiming that ancestral memory. It's a part of revaloring embodied knowledge. And I'll give you an example, like some of these dishes that you've seen me cook, I've been able to do so without a recipe. I can recreate a dish from my childhood based on my memory of its smell, based on my memory of its sight, based on my memory of feel and touch and smell and taste. That's embodied knowledge. That's in me. That's already in me. That's something that I've inherited. That's ancestral memory. We all have that. And so by preserving these dishes, by celebrating our foods, by reclaiming our ancestral food ways, we can reconnect with the land in a more humane way, in a more dignified way, in a way that honors our ancestral struggles around land. And then so in healing the land, we're healing ourselves. And in healing ourselves, we're healing our ancestors.
I love that. It's just so, feels like such an important invitation, both to be guided by what we know without doubt, to remember and reclaim, and to recreate, you know. Thank you so much. I just want to open up and see if there's anything you want to, you know, make sure you share or ask or what have you before we start to transition.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I'd like to share is that, one, as a caregiver, I've been feeling this tug and pull on me to be more active in around racial justice. And I know that protests are like one way that we can show up as far as that's concerned, and we should show up in that way. But I also want to say to all the caregivers out there that you're on the front lines too. And that work is important because that's where all these systems and structures manifest themselves. They show up within ourselves. They show up with our relationships with one another. They show up in our most intimate spaces with one another. They show up in our homes. Those are the front lines. So don't forget that. Care work is what this is all about. Going to a protest, that's care work. Doing electoral politics, that's care work. Dismantling the carceral state, that's care work. Providing care for a loved one, that's care work. It's all interconnected. We're all doing the same work. The other thing I really wanted to bring up is that sometimes I take this for granted, but before I became a facilitator with Emergent Strategies, is that I also benefited from participating in generative somatics. And I know that Adrienne Marie Brown is an instructor for generative somatics, and BOLD as well, which uses some somatics practices as well. And so learning practices of how I can tap into mind-bodied knowledge play directly into my ability and skill and experience as a facilitator for the Emergent Strategies Ideation Institute. And so I really want to invite people to seek out somatics practices and practitioners, and in particular gender somatics, because that's the front line too. And we need all of us. We need our collective strength. We need our collective efforts. We need our collective presence to be in this moment together. And it's by reclaiming our embodied knowledge. It's by reclaiming our humanity. It's by reclaiming our full length, depth, and width in our commitments to our communities that allow us to do this work. So there's a direct connection between somatics practices and emergent strategies and healing work and all of that. So thank you, Mia, for this opportunity. Thank you, Adrienne, for your work. Love you both. And so glad to be in this moment in community with you.
Oh, thank you. We love you too, so deeply, and so appreciate that.
This podcast is produced by Natalie Peart. Music for the Emergent Strategy podcast is provided by Complex Movements, a Detroit-based artist collective. The music provided is from the soundtrack of the performance installation, Beware of the Dandelions. To support the ongoing work of ESII, make a donation at www.alliedmedia.org/ESII.